Is it just about the money, or does the team actually want to get benefit from the situation? So, you know, one of the questions investors will often ask is, well, just how coachable is Dom as chief executive? Does he really want a partnership here where there's some give and take? Or is it just, we want the money and just then get out of our way?
Today, I'm talking with and learning from Mike Hicks. Mike is the founder and CEO of Catalysis Advisory, and his firm's done over 375 projects in mid-market private equity-backed businesses. And Mike and his team specialize in understanding the quality of leadership. Now, I often say to people, they are the best days and the worst days of your business career. And in mid-market PE firms, they are making these investments, and then it will either be brilliant or could go sideways as a result of the leadership team in their investment. And Mike and his team step in and says, you know, what are we doing? Where are we going? Where are we at? How can we help? And so, fantastic conversation, picking his brains to see what common themes he's seen in the companies that he's worked with, working with private equity, to try and ensure that the businesses that they've invested in are a phenomenal success. So irrespective of whether you're PE or VC or even bootstrapped yourself, I think this is a great insight into what's next on your journey and how to overcome those challenges. So great conversation with Mike. I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Hi, I'm Mike Hicks. I run a business called Catalysis Advisory, which hopefully brings together my work over about 30 years working with growth companies and investors. Live happily in Paris and move backwards and forwards to the UK, where most of our clients are. And although it's not very sunny out today, from a business perspective, it's always sunny on our side of the street because we're only really working with successful high growth businesses, wrestling with interesting issues, which keeps life interesting for us.
And what took you to Paris?
I mean, we're an international family. I spent 8 years out in Romania before coming back to the UK. Did a bunch of stuff, ended up in London, and like many people, ended up feeling a bit tired of London. And then the question was, do we go out somewhere else in the UK? Or, you know, because we'd managed to lose all the grandparents for our children, we got out a map and said, where would we like to be from a lifestyle perspective? And looked at the things that we needed as a family and from a work perspective too. And Fontainebleau in France turned out to be really the best place for us.
What had you in Romania for 8 years?
I mean, I went out to Romania in 1990, straight after the revolution.
Uh-huh.
Having been involved pre-revolution in various activities there. Tried to set up various little businesses in 1990 and failed creatively at all of them. Either because the Ukrainian mafia didn't like our business, or because we got ripped off trying to make hush puppy shoes, or because secondhand clothes turned out to be a less good market than we thought they would be. Exporting carpets turned out to require more hard currency than we could get access to. But it was a great learning experience. And then I ended up being asked to set up what is now Deloitte there, although I'm not an accountant. And then I set up something called EBRD, which is a banking operation, although I'm not a banker. And then I set up an investment fund, although I wasn't really an investor. So I think the phrase that gets used is that in the land of the blind, the man with one eye is king. And that was very much me. I didn't know very much, but I knew more than other people around me. And so that meant I could have a very exciting time learning things and breaking new ground.
And set you up for the business you now run.
Because it raised the question of, on the whole, we had a simple strategy with our investments, which was to copy whatever had worked in Poland 2 or 3 years before.
Uh-huh.
So we did mobile phones and we did beer and we did snacks, but we were pretty bad at working out some of the people stuff as investors. You know, who would actually work out, who would be able to scale a business, right? And obviously this was an economy where nobody had a track record of having built companies because it was all been state-owned.
Yeah.
And so calling back to my friends in the UK, I said, well, look, we're pretty rubbish at some of this stuff. You guys must be way ahead of us. And they said, we're talking about late 90s here. the answer came back, no, we're pretty bad at that as well, actually. And so that just intrigued me. But, you know, we made very good money in Romania because we just had all the markets going in our direction. But I realized that this was something which really deserved a bit more attention. And so that became my project since about 1998, trying to work out how to, on the one hand, help investors understand the management part of growing companies. On the other hand, you know, helping particularly first-time chief executives and the teams that they were running going into private equity to help them work out what they were going to need to grow their businesses when, I mean, as you know, Dom, most chief executives in particular don't come from a people and organizational background. They come from a commercial or a financial or an operational background for the most part. And so a lot of this kind of things that you talk about and that we're interested in don't come naturally. They're kind of sidelines almost, but they turn out to be often the most important constraint on growth.
Yes. And sometimes they are. I was talking to somebody last week who sort of said, you know, they just got to the point where it became the whole job and they didn't like it anymore. So that was their time to exit.
Yeah. And I think for some people, there is a phase of a business that they really enjoy. You know, the person who likes building technical solutions and then getting them out in the market may not enjoy that more managerial phase of it. So for some people, there's a kind of a length of road that they like, and then they go back to the start of that same length of road and do the same thing again. And that's a very legitimate way. For some people, you know, I think, you know, they might have two lengths of roads, you know, to go through several, you know, a couple of stages. I think the people who go from a complete startup to running a major, you know, major business, I don't know, Bill Gates or someone, you know, are relatively rare in terms of people who enjoy the whole of that, the whole of that phase.
I think they have a title that looks consistent, but I think the work that they do, you know, Steve Jobs was the CEO of Apple, but I don't think he was doing a typical CEO job. I think he was chief design officer, you know, it's, and so quite often people get hung up on, oh, I'm the CEO, so I should be doing this, 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 and this. And I hate all of those things. So maybe I should replace myself with somebody else. But I think you then lose that, the founder's connection with the customer and the vision. If you're not careful. So what did you find out? What do you now know? How should we dig into this? What are the insights that you now have over the who's going to be good at this?
In terms of good at this, in terms of who will succeed from a chief exec perspective?
Yeah, or the whole team perspective. You know, the, how do you now think about on behalf of either the CEO or the investors, you know, is this team any good?
Yeah, and I mean, I think the starting point to answer that is, well, good for what? Because the situations can vary enormously. So the main framework that myself and my colleagues use starts with asking, what is the actual ask of the management team, right? Because there are three components of that which make sense to us. The first is just how complex is this business model? You know, how many routes to market? How many sites? How many client types? How many offerings have we got? Just how complex is the machinery of the business that we're starting with, regardless of growth? And so some business models are relatively simple. Some are much more complex. The second part is how challenging the market and competitive conditions. You know, there's a business that we worked with last year. They were getting about 20 times more inquiries in than they could possibly handle. Well, that's one end of the market, right? The others, there are businesses where you're fighting for every penny and margins, you know, are scarily thin. So that's another kind of component of the kind of management solution you might need. And the third then is how stretchy is the plan? You know, are we trying to expand into the States, launch three new project, you know, products, go into new client verticals? Just how high are you trying to jump with the business? Because the answer to those three questions will give you some important clues as to the kind of people who are going to succeed. So in my observation, if I just take chief executives for a moment, and I know you asked about the wider team, is, as you said, the title is a title. But below that, what does the person actually have to do? Varies enormously. And I don't think that there is a particular personality type or a particular easy success formula for chief executives. It really depends on what you're trying to do. And then the rest of the team. I think there are some some basic pieces. Again, just keeping on the chief executive for the moment, there are really, you know, beyond the many things that chief executives can do, I think ultimately there are two jobs that are definitely the chief executives. The first is, whether we call it strategy or the set of priorities which the business is pursuing, there is some responsibility, or there is definitely a responsibility for the chief executive to say, where are we going and what are the priorities, you know, to make that direction meaningful. That's one thing. And the other thing then is to make sure that we have in place a team and an organization that is broadly capable of delivering on that strategy or that set of priorities. Everything else, in some senses, are kind of optional jobs, because some chief executives are very commercial, right? They're there all over the client base. Others, they're in the business doing internal things. You know, some chief executives are right down in the detail. Others are kind of up in the clouds thinking about the bigger, longer term picture. And so when we looking at a team, the question firstly, as already mentioned, is, well, what are we asking them to do? And the second then is looking at the various pieces of jigsaw we've got and how they might fit together. And I'm much more interested in that than sort of, I don't know, archetypes of what a chief exec, you know, they need to have a jutting jaw and they need to have charisma. And in practice, and, you know, we've got all the data on the leadership styles. We've got, you know, thousands of data points in that. And there is no strong pattern. There are a few themes which you can pull out. But on the whole, the best predictor of whether a chief executive is going to succeed is the match to the situation. And that's a much more nuanced situation than fitting a certain set of archetypes.
If you're working with investors and you believe that the jigsaw doesn't quite line up, is it replace the CEO, or do you help them shuffle their deck? What's your experience?
So, I mean, you will be familiar with the fact that there can be a fair amount of management changing companies backed by private equity. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be the first place to start. I would say that changing the chief executive, certainly against their will, is pretty rare.
Yeah.
Because typically the private equity houses are looking to back somebody or a small group of people who are they really putting their bets on, and that's usually the chief executive as a starting point. I think if the perception is, here is a business and we don't really reckon that we can work with this chief executive, I think they're going to walk away. They're not going to plot a coup, as it were, unless the chief executive is saying, look, I've reached the end of my capability, invest into the business, let's create a plan, and we're going to bring in a management buy-in person to, so that I can step to the side and become chief product officer or something of that sort.
Yes.
But that, you know, there's more complexity. But if we're talking about a classic deal, then investors are hoping that they're going to feel a sense of confidence that the individual who is telling the story is also going to be able to execute it for a period of time.
I think that will be reassuring to many people that, in your experience, private equity remove the CEO very infrequently. That's probably one of the worries that people have going in. But what are some of the other myths that you think, or misconceptions that founders hold in terms of working with private equity that you see time and time again?
If I may just quickly go back to the previous point about removal of chief executives. And I think, you know, the work that I do is very much sort of small and mid-sized companies, maybe up to 300 or 400 people in the business. Yep. And so what I said is definitely true for that group of the kind of small cap, mid-market type investors. You start getting above that. Firstly, those are more likely to be taking control of a business. And secondly, the view of the disposability of management, I think, changes. The investors at that stage are buying an asset, and the people are there to serve the asset. And if they don't, well, you know, we can find someone else who will. Whereas in my world, they are still very much backing a team. So,
and it's often founder led, and there's that deep connection between the founder and the vision for the business and the customers and understanding of the marketplace and the product.
Exactly. You would be really throwing the dice if you wantonly removed the chief executive in those circumstances.
Yeah.
But sorry, to come back to the question you asked about about myths, the ones that come to mind. I mean, I think one of two ends of a spectrum. The first is that the investors will come in and will just continue as we did previously. And the opposite, which we also hear quite a lot from some teams, is, oh, well, now the private equity are going to become our boss and tell us what to do. And in fact, investors, you know, on the whole, tend to be keen on neither of those extremes. On the one hand, you know, and we could debate this, where you know, how much genuine value investors bring to the table. But certainly their approach is one where they certainly believe that they should be and that they can add value to what a management team is doing by bringing wider perspective, by bringing skills in certain areas, by helping create a framework for value creation. So they definitely want to put their fingerprints on the business, much more than perhaps 20, 30 years ago, when there was more a sense that investors were there to back a horse and we entrust the money into the hands of the chief executive and off you know, she or he will go and hopefully make us a return. But the other end of the spectrum, investors, although they want to have their fingerprints on the business, they don't want to take responsibility for strategy. They're not particularly equipped to do that. They don't want to take responsibility for making things happen because that's definitely not their skill. They don't have the bandwidth for it, nor typically the experience. Most investors tend to come from an accounting, corporate finance, maybe strat consulting background sometimes, but very few of them have come from an operating background. And so that they're neither willing nor able to, you know, to take on the job of becoming the boss of the business and setting, you know, and telling the chief executive what they should be doing. It's the bit in the middle, which is where most of the, you know, where things take place. And my perception compared to 20 years ago is that often when businesses are being brought to market, that the management teams, to me, feel like they're less prepared. They've been less advised on what to expect from the process, mm-hmm. you know, for good or for bad. And often during the conversations we're having with management during a diligence process, we're often doing little impromptu explanations as to how this is going to work in practice. And it's, you know, it's slightly worrying to me that then, you know, that the chief executive is saying, "Oh, really? Is that how it's going to be?" And they actually seem quite cheered up about it in some sense.
And why? What's driving the process to get PE investment then? If they are unaware of the impact it's going to have on running their business, why are they going down this route in the first place? What tends to be the drivers that you see?
I think partly, let's start with the purely financial. You know, I think the UK has never been, you know, like Germany, as much of a, you know, have had as much of a bank funding culture. But nonetheless, the banking sector in the UK, I think I'm right in saying, has shrunk over time. So in terms of your local friendly bank providing a lot of funding for businesses, they've become more conservative over time. And I know there are other funding solutions out there. And so I think, you know, private equity, in some senses, has moved into a funding gap which has existed. So, in all the VCT funds, you know, and private equity as an industry has grown tremendously in 30 years. So, I think a lot of that is about providing equity for businesses, particularly like, I don't know, take a tech businesses, which I know is particularly your domain. A lot of those don't have any assets you could lend against. You know, if you go back to old fashioned banking, you're funding against cash flow and against forecasts. So that's definitely more equity territory than it is banks these days. So that's one reason that perhaps people are going down the private equity route. The second is, if a management team are thinking about how can they become more personally wealthy over time, private equity offers a relatively proximate route for doing that. You know, if over the next 5 years you are able to do a bunch of stuff, there will be an event at which point, you know, you probably get some cash out from that. So, I mean, I think in that sense, you know, what other routes are there? Well, you sell out to a corporate. That's a lot less certain of a route. Private equity, because there's so much money now, can take people up a ladder of equity events.
Uh-huh.
I mean, again, if I think about my days as an investor, The other aspect that's changed is it's become much more normalized. I mean, when I used to talk to management teams back in the late 90s, you know, the idea of equity, they would say, well, what's the interest on the equity? Just to, you know, how does that, and I'm not making fun of people then. It was just unfamiliar as a concept. Whereas now private equity is kind of all over the place. People will know people who've been through it and have survived and maybe made some money from it. And so it's just become culturally, I think, you know, a more, you know, a less scary option than it was once.
Yeah. What else do people have in their misconceptions, maybe, or maybe even the, you know, how are people not thinking the right way about setting their business up for acquisition?
The one which mostly occurs to me is, so a management team goes to a corporate finance advisor and says, we're thinking of going down the private equity route. Corporate finance advisor says, well, okay, let's look at the value of your business. You're making 2 million of EBITDA in your industry. We're going to apply a 6x multiple on that or whatever it is. So the value is X that we're going to go out to market with. What the corporate finance advisor doesn't say at that stage is that when the management team now encounters the investors, they're going to be asking a lot of questions about other things beyond the basic valuation equation. And some of that will come into areas which obviously I'm interested in, I think you are as well, about scalability, for example. You know, a business which can demonstrate that it knows how to go to the next level is going to attract a higher multiple and a more friendly response than those who can look at an exciting past, but often then when we start looking at it, you realize, okay, this business is essentially underinvested. It's almost anorexic in terms of from overhead. It's clearly been prepped in such a way to look like its earnings are bigger than they really are. Mm-hmm. And then we're getting into the conversation with our investors saying, you know, there's probably £500,000 of overhead, which really should be here to run the business at this scale. I know that's obviously going to be slightly subjective, but you can see some businesses. I mean, I'll give you an example. There was a business we worked on in a pump manufacturer. And when we went to try and find the finance director to have a conversation with him, he said, no, sorry, I can't do now. I'm on the phones. It's like, sorry, you've got calls. No, I'm actually doing reception. And there was a rota amongst the top team because they didn't want to spend whatever it was. This is a few years ago now. I don't know, 20 grand or whatever it would have been to hire a receptionist who could do other things. That was rotated amongst the management team because everybody else was actually manufacturing pumps. You know, this is an example of a business which was, I mean, that was just silly, right? Because you would hope the finance director and the other directors could find better uses of their time, potentially.
Yes, you'd hope.
Perhaps the sales director could be selling, for example, or the operations director improving efficiencies or whatever the answer was. So, and it goes back to the point about, is it just about the money or does the team actually want to get benefit from the situation? So, you know, one of the questions investors will often ask is, well, just how coachable is, you know, is Dom as chief executive? Does he really want a partnership here where there's some give and take, or is it just we want the money and just then get out of our way? That can come across in the kind of processes that we're involved with. And, you know, again, going back to something we discussed earlier on, there is a balance here. It's not like you want a chief executive says, you know, yes, sir, no, no, sir, three bags full, sir. But nor do you want somebody who just says, well, I will run this in the way I've always run it by myself, despite having a, you know, significant investment coming in.
You've got a new book coming out in the new year, Assessing and Strengthening Teams and Organizations. And it's written for investors.
This book is written for investors. That's right. Because that's to answer one side of my world, which is about how investors engage with companies. So yes, the material in there is targeted at sort of a 32-year-old investor, probably getting into their first board situations, never really had to deal that much with people and strategy and organization issues, and is intended to provide some practical advice for them dealing with those issues. Not as an expert, they don't have to become an expert, but at least to know how to ask the right questions and not to take too many things for granted. So yeah, that is the purpose of that book. I would hope that during the course of next year, and having survived the process of writing the first one, that there will be an alternate version of that written, particularly for chief execs and chairs.
Okay. Of likewise stepping into board seats for the first time, or having raised money now, having a board for the first time.
Exactly so. And, you know, some of the questions that you've been asking probably, you know, to address there. Well, what does it really mean to become, entangled in private equity? What to look out for? You know, one of the joint tasks is to set up expectations in the boardroom. I mean, if a transaction has been done, you know, how do we define the detail of the strategy? You know, how much does the board need to get involved with that? What's the role of a chair in these situations? You know, how much can we invest into the team and organization for scalability?
For a mid-market company, what do you think what's a good size board, and who would be on it?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's one which comes up a lot, because sometimes the assumption from management team, let's say there are five people in the management team, and there's a lack of clarity about them as a senior team as opposed to the board.
Yep.
And there's kind of an assumption, for the five of us, plus the chair, plus maybe two investors, you know, that then becomes eight people, which starts to feel a little unwieldy.
Yep.
And so the way I would normally talk about that with management teams is, look, there's going to be the management board, which is the five of you, which feels like a good size. Then there's going to be the financial board. You're going to have the chair, the investors, probably certainly the chief executive, probably the finance director, maybe possibly one other, but
yep,
probably no more than that. And the purpose of that board is not to make all the decisions about the business. It's to make sure that governance is working, that the strategy is about right, that the value creation framework that we're using doesn't confuse or undermine the business. That board has a quite specific and, I think, limited purpose. And so you, as head of operations, do you really want to be spending your time looking at the spreadsheets, or do you think you might have more fun just working the management board and dealing with your, you know, managerial issues? So our advice would normally be, try and keep that top board, that financial board, probably no more than five people overall.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, I think you've written about this too. You get beyond a certain point, and it becomes either too much of a kind of ongoing show and tell. Everyone's kind of becomes very retrospective. Now the sales director does you know his bit. Now the finance director does her bit, and it all becomes very stale. By definition, you've got all the best paid people in the business there, plus non execs. So yeah, I think keeping that relatively tight is usually the best approach.
Yes, and often then people say, well, I'm going to put some non-execs in there that know, you know, something about our journey. And it's like, well, maybe, but, you know, maybe they don't want to go to the board meeting. Maybe that's not that finance board meeting. Maybe you have an advisory board. They don't need to be non-exec directors. Maybe, you know, you just meet once a quarter or once every whatever, and tap into their knowledge about the future. And you don't have to have it as part of that regulatory framework.
Well, correct. And, you know, the responsibilities under company law are not always for the faint-hearted, particularly if a business, you know, gets into trading issues and so on. I agree with you on that, Dom. I mean, the purpose of the board has a very specific, you know, shape and responsibility. And anyone who should, you know, who don't need there absolutely just shouldn't be there, really. You know, you're taking on all sorts of responsibilities beyond those of yourself if you're an operational manager or as non-exec for that matter, you know, unless you've, I'd agree. That kind of advisory board, we want to understand how we go into the States, or, you know, we're thinking of adding new products in a certain vertical. Yeah, unless that's very central to the plan, I can't see why you'd want to have that in the board.
Yeah. You know, and it might be that the investors are interested in meeting these people as well. But again, you can do that outside of the regulatory board meeting.
Well, or you can invite people in on a one-off basis. I mean, and it's not unusual that you'd bring, I don't know, the sales director would come in every quarter and give an update on what's happening with pipeline. And that's great. But they don't have to be a board director to come into the meeting. And the same is true with that sort of industry advisor that you're appointing to.
Let me interrupt the conversation just for a minute, because I don't want you to miss this. My new book, Mind Your Fucking Business, is out on Amazon. If you're thinking yet another business book, I think you're wrong. This is actually a blueprint to cutting through the noise and achieving unparalleled success for you. It's based on 10 years of business coaching, spotting similar problems that people have had, and coming up with real world solutions. If it's supercharging sales, if it's mastering talent acquisition, building a powerhouse brand, cultivating a company culture that breeds success, then this book is a ticket to your transformative journey. It's filled with practical tools and frameworks that I use every single day with my clients as part of their coaching program. If you want to take your business from good to great, look, you can go to Amazon and you can buy it, or you can click the link in the show notes and head over to monkhouseandcompany.com. I'll send it to you today. I'll send you a copy for free. I want to help you build a fantastic business. Now, back to the conversation. What are some of the other things that you see this sort of early 30s new to boards from their perspective? What do they get wrong often? Maybe we're diving into some of the content that's in the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm going to refer here to a piece I wrote a few years ago called The Seven Sins of Post-Deal Strategy. And I mentioned that because I'd had a series of, there have been a series of pieces of work which we've been asked to do where good investors with good management teams, with good basic business models, had managed to trip over their shoelaces pretty badly within 6 months of a deal happening.
Okay.
And that just intrigued me because there was no obvious sort of idiot there. All the intentions were good. And somehow all these clever people had managed to make a mess. And if I just run through those, because I think that's...
Sure.
I'm not putting that all necessarily onto the investor director, but it's often blind spots for those people which can allow that to take place. So one is, you know, in a transaction, there's a lot of due diligence done. And some of the, you know, many of the transactions we're working on, you're hundreds of thousands or millions of pounds of money being spent on accountants and lawyers and consultants of various flavors. And then, curiously, a lot of that just gets parked. The deal gets done and we kind of just shelve it. And not very much is extracted from it for the benefit of management teams. The second is...
I am always amazed. We had a client here last week who, obviously, the PE house, when they acquired them, did a load of due diligence and never shared any of that with management.
Good Lord.
And the whole stuff about, the TAM and, addressable market and all these things that, the investment committee would need to make a decision, which they now know because they've paid somebody to update, tell them, never shared with management.
I think that's relatively rare. I mean, usually, at least, certainly the commercial, the financial, the legal, or at least parts of the legal would typically be shared. You know, we're always very keen that our work, because it's all around team and organization and scalability, you know, we would always tell management teams that you are our client as well. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, what the hell's the point, right? We don't see ourselves as diligence people. We see ourselves as team and organization strategists. It's because, sorry, going off on site tangent, all the companies we work with are successful businesses.
Yep.
Very few of them and I don't mean to be insulting, you would rate us more than a 6 or 7 out of 10 from a team and organization perspective, just because they've got growing pains and because, knowingly the management teams are on a journey. And so what that means then is, as long as we're not a 3 out of 10 or 4 out of 10, then this is a backable business. But there's a whole bunch of things around the roadmap for the organization which need to be understood and planned and alongside everything else within the post-deal. And so we can't do that unless we can talk about it with the team and maybe check whether our understandings are correct or whether maybe we've got some things wrong. But in particular, to agree on what the next steps would be, the recommendations. Yeah, so look, I think that not getting benefit from due diligence, it bewilders me as well from everyone's perspective. The second is misunderstanding strategy. So one of the problems that private equity has structurally is quite early in a conversation with a management team, a financial model needs to be built. Mm-hmm. That needs to be driven by a bunch of assumptions, which means that there is no real time to talk about strategy in any meaningful sense. We go quite quickly from management plan to a financial forecast, and they say change some of the assumptions here and there. We sensitize those, the spreadsheets. But in terms of really talking about, well, have you as management really thought enough about some of the dilemmas you've got, some of the options that are available to you? In practice, a lot of that stuff gets short-circuited, and we get straight into what's called a strategy, but really is just words around a financial model. Mm-hmm. And then post-deal, we get to that stage. Nobody wants to reopen the conversation about strategy because, well, we've now got a plan.
The Excel spreadsheet becomes the strategy.
Well, but of course, it becomes the goals and it becomes the numbers. But what it doesn't provide is the why. And if I'm then going down to my second and third tier managers and trying to explain, well, here's what we've signed up to, guys and gals, there's no why in there, really. I mean, the management will, I'm sure, find words for it. But in terms of whether this is the best possible set of options that we could, and whether it's an executable strategy as opposed to a bunch of goals, that's where we get lost in terms of from a strategy perspective, what we can do. Uh-huh. I think the third thing where our 32-year-old first-time board director may struggle is just understanding organizational inertia. The fact that you can think it doesn't mean that it's going to be easy to execute.
Okay.
And so particularly when after transaction, a management team has been distracted typically for 6, 9, 12 months by a process. They've to some extent been neglecting their colleagues and their clients because, there's this whole wedge of time that has been consumed by the process. But there's no allowance for that. And so the idea that, okay, great, now we've got the funding in place, the investors are pushing for value creation actions or acquisitions or whatever it is, but the organization needs to pick itself up and re-energize itself, refocus itself. And I think the fact that stuff takes time is often, again, ignored. And the risk is that we launch a whole bunch of new initiatives without really the capacity to deal with them. Which brings me to the fourth thing, which is confusing change activity with change results. So, as you know very well, you can keep adding in change initiatives, so we're kind of ever busier, but you can end up with a traffic jam of change initiatives such that the more we do, the less results we get. Mm-hmm. And that's very counterintuitive for ambitious and energetic people, that actually you might get more, you might get better and more results from doing less. And again, to tell a little story there, there was an engineering business that we worked with a few years ago who had identified for themselves, I think it was like 65 strategic initiatives in their business, many of which were clearly not strategic. But the point is that the business had almost ground to a halt. They had quality issues, morale issues, organizational issues. But fundamentally, the cause of all of that was they were just overloaded. There was no time to actually manage colleagues, clients, the actual client projects, because everyone was so busy trying to do change stuff. And we had a big bonfire of initiatives, which massively freed up energy to do the few things that really mattered. And I know we all know we overcommit and we should cut back on our priorities. But in practice, most of us really struggle with that in practice.
We spend a lot of time with clients giving them some simple methodologies, putting things on a not-to-do list. So instead of saying, yes, I'll do that, just say, no, I won't do that, because then that forces the conversation about prioritization, right? And just, Andre, who's one of the coaches here, he has a whole program that he works through with executive teams on that. Stop giving away your integrity by saying you'll do a thing that you have, well, you obviously have an intention of doing it, but frankly, you have no capacity to do. Stop.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then you get to, well, okay, if you want to do anything more, then we need to agree, what two things you're going to stop doing.
Yeah, totally.
Are there any clients we can get rid of? That can seem like a heretical thing to say, but some clients are just consuming so much bandwidth or not producing margin. Maybe it's better off without them.
When I say, let's have a look at our product and customer profitability. People go, well, that's not data we've got. Well, let's maybe we start there then. How do we work this out? There's going to be a way to work it out, even if it's broadly correct. So let's have a go.
Yeah, and the reality is when you ask that question, you say, if there was one client you could get rid of and who everybody would be happy with getting rid of, and they all know the answer to that.
Totally. And my experience was when we've got the, when you overlay the data, that, that client and the data all show the same things. It's very rare that the client everybody hates is making you loads of money.
Yeah, absolutely. They, we know that that's the case. So just to maybe to finish off, so in terms of the fifth deadly sin, and this definitely comes from the kind of corporate finance or accounting background, which is assuming that target and financial incentives will get people to do the right things. Whereas in practice, as again, as you know, sometimes those targets and incentives can actually get people to do the wrong things because people take shortcuts or because it takes away from things that we're kind of assuming that people will keep doing, but actually we end up sucking the oxygen from. And again, private equity can be guilty of just assuming that if the money points in one direction, that that will override other people's other concerns. Sixth, you know, deadly sin is just rushing key people decisions. You know, the investors have told us we need to get a sales director. Not quite happy with Bob, but you know what he'll do. And then again, you've talked about this a lot, Dom. You know, you hire in haste and regret. At your own leisure, and that particularly for senior roles can delay us by many months. By the time you've worked out that they're not good, and the opportunity cost of that can be huge.
I think in these size businesses, often then they have no track record of hiring senior people, right? Because most of the senior people have been around for quite a while already, and they've grown up with the business, and so it might be the first time they've ever done it. And, you know, there's a scorecard doesn't exist and there's no real clarity about what a great candidate is. And then they start a recruitment process and they're talking to candidates, but they haven't, not everybody's on the same page about what great looks like, what their background is. You know, so often they're hiring somebody from a big company who has never built a process and they're a scale up where they need somebody who's a bit more of a street fighter, could create chaos out of, create something out of chaos, has some can work from first principles. All of these things just need to be prioritized before you hire any recruiter.
Absolutely. And look, recruiters also will tell you, because it's an area which we work in helping clients. I mean, we've built tools to help clients clarify the hierarchy of criteria in the job spec. Because most of us, when we're asked to write a job spec, usually write three or four quite sensible points and then start writing a bunch of rubbish about, I don't know, charismatic and good communicator and just kind of sort of more adjectival kind of things. And for a recruiter, those don't mean very much when you're trying to, you know, how much do they really need to come from our industry? Do they need to have come from a bigger business? Do they need to have had experience of certain international markets? Do they need to know types of clients? These are the crunchy things which a headhunter can search on. But when you write a three-page job spec and it says basically just you describe a superwoman or superman, you've got a problem because the headhunter can't search on that, and nor can we really select against it. So we end up with a big squidgy mess of views. And then the headhunter comes back and we say, sorry, didn't quite mean that. They need to be left-handed and you know have red hair, which just wastes time and annoys the headhunter. So. I mean, look, my lovely example of this, there was an IT consulting business, a great business up in Scotland that we worked with some years ago. And they had some issues with the way their operations were working, and found an amazing woman who'd worked most of her career in, I think it was BP or Shell, one of those, was a superstar within the Shell context. And this business had 150 people that I was dealing with. And I said to the chief executive, she's amazing, don't hire her, which I think confused him initially. I said, look, she is great, but she's just not great for your business. But he had always kind of professionally speaking had fallen in love with her because she was just so impressive. She was intelligent. She was charismatic. She could think strategically. What she couldn't do, as it turned out, because he went and hired her, was he couldn't sort out 150 person organizations' operational issues. And he did, to his credit, he did call me and say, now I understand what you meant. but it's to your point, Dom, which is it's about horses for courses, is that there is, you know, don't just go and buy the, you know, the best thoroughbred flat racing horse when what you need is a, you know, something for going across fences.
Yeah.
The last and final seven of the seven sins is about unbalanced governance. which is the risk that we've now created a financial board with a chair and an investor or two, and they forget that the main purpose of the board and of strategy is to help our people and our clients to understand what we're trying to do, what the focus is, as opposed to feeding upwards to give investors or anybody else stuff at the top. Again, I'll give you a little example of this. There was a business we worked with in the engineering repair arena where investors arrived. And this is a business where most of the work got done in the summer. And this deal got done in, I think, May. They got on a big new contract. And the chair appointed by the investors wanted to show his stuff to the investors, show that he was adding value to the situation, and asked, or basically forced, the chief executive to spend most of his summer writing a 15,000 word document, on the future strategy of the business. Meanwhile, the business was spiraling into chaos because it turned out the chief exec really was the head of operations of the business. That was his main contributor, and they'd increased activity by about 50% during the summer. Basically, the thing fell to pieces, and we were brought in at a stage when things were really quite messy. The chair didn't survive very long. They hadn't spent the time to understand, again, the due diligence piece, they hadn't taken the time to understand the way the team worked, but thought it would be a good idea to get the chief executive to become a strategy document writer, which was the last thing that he wanted to do or could do, frankly. Mm-hmm. But that's an example of unbalanced governance, because he didn't realize that he could say no and say, maybe we do this in the autumn or something.
Yeah.
He said, well, these guys have bought the business. I should just do what I'm told, right? Even to the point of really damaging the business and everyone's interests.
Yes.
And it took 2 years to get things back on track.
We'll share some links in the show notes so people can pick up a copy of your book in the new year. I was going to ask you some quick fire questions, if I can.
Please.
What drives you every day?
What I get a really big kick from is finding low-hanging fruit in organizations and helping make a few people's lives better. And what I mean by that is, again, example, a CTO who really shouldn't be a CTO and would be much happier being chief software architect, and making that happen and getting people into the right boxes where they are both happier and more productive. It's a little win-win.
Yes, those people who have been over-promoted and don't know how to get unpromoted again. Yes, excellent. Lovely.
So it's this solving those little problems I think of that as corporate physiotherapy. It's not surgery. It's not just an aspirin, but it's some chronic pain without which the business can't move forward. And I'm doing that little, I don't know, bit of chiropractic crack into the back. And that's what I get a kick from is finding those moments.
Brilliant. And so what's your genius?
My genius is thinking slower than my clients. They're all in a terrible rush to make things happen. I think my genius is being curious, sitting back and trying to work out what it might be that they're missing. And it's usually nothing particularly clever. It's doing a lot of the basic things right. And again, I know that's a big theme of your work as well, is often the opportunities for significant improvements come from simple things rather than clever things.
Okay. What unpopular opinion do you hold?
The opinion that, and I suppose this question is unpopular with whom? With some of our investor clients, probably the opinion that they are adding less value than they hope and say that they're adding. We collect data from management teams, and their views of governance are not always particularly flattering about what they're getting from private equity houses. Again, I don't think that's because private equity houses are unable to add value, but often they're not thinking enough about the seven sins that I mentioned. And so maybe that's uncomfortable rather than unpopular. That's where it's important for people like us to be able to give clients what they need, not just what they want. And sometimes that's saying maybe it's not working as well as you hope.
What's the biggest risk you've taken?
Probably was when I left university. I had various quite exciting job offers to do sensible things in the UK and going off to try and create my own little businesses in the chaos of 1990 Romania probably was a bit of jumping off the cliff.
Yeah.
But I mean, there are various moments in my career where I've jumped off cliffs. When I was invited to come back from Romania to get a, you know, to do proper banking back in London. Again, I wish went independent again. You know, I've created my own business, a couple of times, which makes the brain go a bit quicker, makes things feel a bit realer.
What's the most recent thing you've learned or skill you've acquired?
Two skills at low levels that I've acquired, both of which I'm quite proud of. The first was my children teaching me to ski. I never skied until about 4 or 5 years ago. And so now I'm the kind of king of the green slopes. And that, for me, was very character building to not mind looking like an idiot. And actually, I've come to quite enjoy that. More recently, the equivalent for that is starting to use AI for certain internal processes. Mm-hmm. Again, doesn't come naturally to me, but it's been really interesting to play with ChatGPT and most recently with Claude, and just realize that there are certain things it can do better than I can. And so that's still at an early stage, but I've been, it's like learning a new language. And I feel like I'm at least order a cup of coffee in AI now.
And say thank you and can I have the bill? Yes. What's the biggest myth in business for you?
This goes back to my doctoral work, looking at the history of management, recruitment and selection. The biggest myth is that with all our modern clothes and processes, that we've actually got better at some of the basics. So I can tell you from experience of looking what companies were doing 100 years ago in recruiting talent, that we haven't got a whole lot better. And that's quite a surprising conclusion, but I we could have a good argument about it. Despite all sorts of different tools and processes and apps and whatever, the practice of what people do still is relatively random. It's that everything improves with in the world, and the reality is a lot of the stuff that I'm interested in, I think that you're interested in, whether it's strategy or people stuff, we're still, as a business community, relatively primitive at.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. What books have you been reading, or what books have you read along the way on your journey that you found meaningful, inspirational, or that you think people should pick up and read as well?
I mean, I'll give my most recent book that I absolutely devoured, which I hadn't, it's a few years old. It's a business called Alchemy by Rory Sutherland.
Okay.
That is tremendous. I just was looking, hunting for Christmas presents the other day and just saw this and grabbed it and spent a very long evening reading it, basically arguing that anything meaningful in business needs to revel in the fact that lots of really important things appear illogical, counterintuitive, and that his argument is that we have so formalized lots of our ways of thinking about business into kind of Excel sheets and formal processes that we've forgotten that a lot of what matters in dealing with colleagues and clients, in fact, is really about psychology and emotion. I work in an industry that is supposedly super rational, very numbers oriented, but in practice, lots of decisions that get made are relatively emotional, but they just don't realize that it is.
All decisions are emotional.
Yeah, absolutely. But after that, we then rationalize them with numbers, and that's the question is how much are we conscious of that process? There have been a lot of books that have been quite influential on me. So I'm just looking at my bookshelves next to me. There's a book, I think you'll know, The Hard Thing About Hard Things. You familiar?
Yeah.
It's one that I quite enjoy, and it's one that I recommend quite a lot because it's kind of bite-sized knowledge.
Yep.
A lot of our clients, whether they're chief execs or chairs or investors, don't feel like they have the time to read, full books. And I think between, excellent podcasts like this, blogs, that's another thing which can be absorbed in small enough sizes that it might actually be acted upon.
Yep. Very good. Mike, thank you very much indeed for coming on the show today. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.